Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9, here again with the wonderful Mark Rusinovich. I heard you wrote a book and everything.
Yeah, a few, actually.
Like a lot of them. Not just like, I'm not talking about like computer book, but like a fictional, like stuff that's happening now that you wrote about like a couple years ago.
Yeah, actually wrote three cybersecurity thriller, just called the Jeff Akin series, and wrote Zero Day, Trojan Horse, and Rogue Code.
One day I'll do something useful and I'll show it to you and then you can write for me. It's gonna be great. But last time we actually spent some time talking about blockchain. We talked about Ethereum and how those things actually work, which was very informative to me. But one of the things that we talked about is we talked about smart contracts. Mm-hmm. We talked about how they would use it sort of in the system of multiple consumers and producers type thing. I'm trying to understand like why business would use it beyond that. So tell us about business interests.
Sure. So distributed ledgers have a couple of interesting properties for business. If you take a look at the way that business to business works, as opposed to the public scenarios we've really focused on last time, which was more cryptocurrency and public to the internet, anonymous transactions and smart contracts. With business to business, the current challenges that they've got today are central, based on the fact that everybody's got their own centralized ledger where they keep a view of the state of the world. Or they've got to rely on some central authority to maintain the truth. And that's problematic for a lot of scenarios. Where in peer-to-peer scenarios, for example, or one-to-many or end-by-M kind of relationships, where you can end up with ledgers, these databases that get out of sync with each other. And they can get out of sync, which causes reconciliation problems. Nobody's really sure of where assets are located. And their fraud can show up as well.
Oh, I see.
And so a lot of these kinds of consortiums end up creating a neutral third party to kind of arbitrate everything. And you see this in the financial systems. For example, SWIFT is an example of that.
I see.
Financial clearinghouse where they sit between the banks and kind of back transactions and keep track of where things are in a central place. But in many business-to-business scenarios, and including financial, that just adds friction and overhead and latency. And so many of them are looking at distributed ledgers as an opportunity to remove that and improve efficiency.
Oh, I see. So because maybe this wasn't entirely clear to me, but when you're using something like Ethereum and smart contracts, that's everyone can see that.
That's right. And so everybody can see it. And once there's something that's been updated on that blockchain, it's committed and everybody knows exactly what's happened. So everybody sees the state of all the assets, whether it's cryptocurrency or some other asset that these transactions are representing or modifying. And the blockchain keeps the source of truth, and everybody's got a copy of it, so everybody's totally in sync with each other.
And that might not be useful if you have a consortium of bankers, for example, or mortgage lenders, or stores, for example. Everybody doesn't want everything on one chain.
Yeah, well, actually, those are, you hit on the key scenarios that are all interested in blockchain or distributed ledger technology. There's a number of challenges that they run into when they try to take one of these ledgers and deploy it in that kind of consortium organization. And a couple of the, just to kind of complete some of the places where we see the need and push for this very strongly, one of them is financial. So financial clearing within an organization, so some of the kind of global scale companies that we work with, they've got multiple departments that are transacting with each other. And we've talked to them and they say, we've got this reconciliation problem, yet, and then we say, wait, you're all the same company, why don't you just designate somebody to be the central database? And they're like, no, we kind of, you know, everybody's peer-to-peer, we don't really trust each other, you know, trust anybody to do it right, so we'd really like to have a leveraged blockchain type technology to do this.
So there's no way to do, have like some privacy in your own group of people.
Yeah, and let me, in the financial example, where you could potentially have banks that are transacting with each other, they would ideally not want other banks to see transactions that they're not participants in.
Even though they're anonymous, they could still be traced.
That's right. Yep. And so you can piece together information, and especially in smart contracts where there's state that's visible and the code's visible, you can also kind of get an insight into who's doing what just based on that. So there's leakage of information, potentially, of various degrees that they're concerned with. Not just in the financial case, I don't want other banks to see my transactions with this bank, but in supply chain, you kind of mentioned that. That is a very big scenario for distributed ledgers. You know, supply chain, lots of suppliers, retailers, everybody has a hard time of keeping track where inventory is and where what the status of the purchase orders and where things have been delivered. And and prices. And so all of this is results in fraud and waste and friction, and whether it's a retailer like a store working with its suppliers or a manufacturing company working with its suppliers, mm-hmm. they all have this kind of problem that they want to go address with blockchains. Yet they've got the confidentiality problem. In the case of the retailer, the suppliers shouldn't be able to see each other's orders or inventory,
right?
Or the prices that they've negotiated with the retailer,
right?
Or the you know the company that's actually using their supply chains. And so the retailer might have viewed everything or desired view on everything, but the suppliers shouldn't. In the case of a supply chain network that has multiple retailers and suppliers, you don't want retailers to see each other's, what's going on with each other. But blockchain as it exists is really hard to deploy in an environment like that because of the confidentiality problem.
The other thing, there was other two things that because I've been thinking about it. It's been like a couple days since we did the last video. I was thinking about like with the smart contracts, for example, how do you get a group of people to agree what can go in a smart contract, and then how do you protect that? You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I feel like if there's a group of people that are not necessarily antagonistic, but maybe competitive, you know, how do they all agree on these things that's in a public?
Yeah, that's a great question too. And blockchain networks today leave that as an out of band exercise. What we call governance of the blockchain and the rules of the blockchain and who can participate in the blockchain, what code we all agree on in a consortium network. A little bit different than the public, which is, you know, big movement of the public mining nodes to all upgrade. You see this happen periodically. But in a consortium, to keep business going, everybody's got to get upgraded and move. And, or one, you know, in that bank example, one bank wants to add another bank to the network. Now they've got to go out of band, talk to all the other banks, and get everybody to agree to add this bank to the network. Or come up with some other governance that's completely out of band. So governance of the blockchain of these networks is also problematic because you run into a lot of the same problems that the blockchain's there to try to address.
I see. And then the last thing was, we talked about these hashes, you know, being generated, the nonce being generated to match the hash for these blocks to come out. And these things took on the order of hours, which meant that transaction that I wanted to do would take several hours to post. Wouldn't that be a problem for a banking business, for example?
Yeah, it's definitely a problem. So you hit on the latency problem that mining causes. Mining also a huge waste of energy. The amount of energy that's used to mine Bitcoin can power a large, you know, medium-sized American city right now for every day.
Wow.
So it's getting up there in terms of just pure waste. But it's the latency problem, and there's a throughput problem too. The size of the blocks are limited in these networks as well, and these kind of networks that we've been talking about. And so that means not only is there high latency, but the throughput's really low as well. Like Ethereum public network, it targets between 10 and 20 milliseconds for a block to be mined. Certain limited number of transactions in a block, which results in a throughput of somewhere between 15 and 25 transactions per second. Uh-huh. Far off like what enterprises are used to in centralized databases.
Right.
Or what they might need in many of these scenarios, like a supply chain where there's thousands of parts, you know, being.
I mean, that sounds like it's fast.
Yeah.
But imagine you're in a scenario where you're like buying stuff off of like eBay.
Yeah.
How many transactions is the user going to wait there and then everyone's going to get backed up? Feels like that would take a long time.
Like Visa, they've talked a little bit publicly about the number of transactions that they process every second, and somewhere between 2,000 and 5,000.
Ooh. So that would take on the order of hours to do.
Exactly.
Okay, so the thing that was interesting to me is the reason why I asked you is because we came up with this thing called Cocoa Framework.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure, is it like a new implementation of Ethereum? Is it a new kind of blockchain? The other thing is it a cloud thing? How does this work? And I wanted to talk to you about what it is that we actually built.
Yep. Great question. So first of all, it's not a ledger. It's not a new blockchain itself. It's an enabling technology that blockchains can be integrated with.
I see.
So if we were to draw it in a kind of the architectural layer, at the bottom we've got what are called TEEs, and I'll talk about those in a second. And some examples of those are SGX, VSM, which we'll talk about. That's the foundation for Cocoa. And then the layer above this is the Cocoa runtime. And then above this are ledgers like Ethereum, like quorum like Sawtooth Lake, which is Intel's.
Okay.
And anything can actually be integrated on top of this.
So usually when I see this, I'm a programmer, and every time I see pictures like that, I'm thinking like these are assemblies or some kind of DLL or some kind of code. Is this all code, or is this, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so this is either software or hardware. This is code, libraries, and executables.
And this is
blockchain. And then this is the blockchain implementation that's integrated with this layer beneath it.
Okay, so let's talk about the bottom part, because I don't know what TE is. Yeah. I've never heard of this. We're going to start talking about this, and we've learned about what these are.
Yeah.
So let's talk about these first.
Let's start with what TEEs are. And the simplest way to think about a TEE is that you've got a computer, and then a TEE is a black box in that computer. You can put data into that, and you can put code into this. And the data is invisible from the outside. It's can't be accessed from the outside computing environment, whether it's the admin or whether it's the hypervisor. In the case of SGX, a hardware-based thing, it's really completely sealed. One way to think of it is, you know, you've probably heard the expression encryption at rest, which is your data is encrypted when it's stored to disk. Encryption in motion, which is encrypting when you're sending it over the network. This is encryption in use. So the data is basically encrypted while it's being computed and can't be accessed from the outside.
So is like the OS doing something to prevent this? Is it like a VM or a container or something like that?
Yep. So in the case of SGX, it's the hardware itself.
Okay.
So Intel's developed this technology, which is this trusted execution environment. You can load code into it, and then you can give data to it, encrypted data, such that only the code inside the SGX enclave can see and process that data.
I see. Okay.
I had VSM on there. That is virtual secure mode, and that is a software-based TEE that we created as part of Windows Server 2016.
Okay.
It is a black box that is protected by the hypervisor. So the host operating system and admin there can't get access to inside that box.
Is it similar to some like isolated user mode that came out?
Similar, yeah.
Okay.
So if you heard of virtualization-based security are all kind of based on that same technology of the hypervisor protecting an enclave where code runs.
And this is like the OS like rejecting calls to address spaces.
That's right. Yeah,
okay.
Completely isolating the address space
cool.
and protecting it.
So the thing I'm seeing here, because this is very familiar to me, when we talked about Ethereum, we talked about that there was code and data in those contracts.
Yeah.
So what are we doing with this to make these things a little bit better?
So what we do with Coco, by leveraging the isolation properties and the security properties of a trusted execution environment, we create a trusted network. So let's say we've got a consortium of four members, and they establish their network like this.
Okay.
This is M1, M2, and M3, and M4. And now there's a piece of code for the Coco framework that they all approve of running their network with. There's the ledger code that they all agree that they're going to run their network with, some version of Ethereum, for example. And then there's what we call the constitution of the network, which is where you put the governance rules.
Okay.
And I'll get back to governance rules in a minute. One of the properties of an SGX enclave or VSM enclave or any other enclave is that they can attest to what's been loaded inside them, meaning they can offer proof to somebody else, hey, I'm running version one of you know, Ledger, distributed Ledger. Mm-hmm. I'm running version three of Coco, and I've got a constitution version, you know, version five.
Okay.
All of this, they can produce an attestation to this that is backed by whatever the trusted root authority is. In the case of SGX, it would be Intel hardware saying, this is the stuff that's been loaded into this enclave.
I see. So it's like member two, if something comes from member one, member two knows mathematically this is what's running.
Yep.
There's no other way that there's some other data that has been tampered or something else is running.
Yep.
Okay.
Now, based on that attestation and the fact that you have this black box, member two can say, I'm only going to establish a network with any other member that has proves that it's running this stuff.
Okay.
Because I trust everything in here to operate the rules and protect my confidentiality and protect my data.
Sure.
And once they prove to each other that they're running the approved versions of code and configuration, trusted network forms that is completely sealed from the outside world. Nothing else can see into this thing.
Oh, I see. This is where the privacy comes in.
Yeah, then they can talk to each other. They can send the information with each other that's encrypted such that only these enclaves can decrypt it and see it. And so now they've got this foundation that we can build these cool properties on top of to enable blockchains for enterprises.
So if there's bad guy A comes in here, gets on the network, starts sniffing packets, they're reading garbage.
Yep, reading garbage. And if bad guy A ends up on this computer where this enclave is, he can't get access into it.
Because if they were to tamper somehow with the enclave, the signed stuff that would come out would not have the verification.
Well, actually, you can't tamper with the enclave.
Oh, okay. Because
the isolation boundary is protecting that.
Yeah.
What you can do is you can do denial of service, but you can't mess with what the enclave. You could try to start an enclave that has different versions, but then the network's going to reject it.
I see. And so what you do is you build, because of these enclaves, now you can build a distributed ledger on top of those things that have the protected contract and the data in the enclaves that are irrefutable.
Exactly. So now with that trusted TEE-based network, so you've got the TEE here, and we've got the COCO code, and then we've got the distributed ledger code in here, and then we've got the constitution. And they're communicating with the outside world, and users, members themselves, can submit transactions to this, to their own node. This might be member one's node. They can submit a transaction to this. And again, the transaction's encrypted such that only this TEE knows how to decrypt it. Now, this TEE says, oh, I got a transaction. It validates it, says, look, this is a good transaction. It's not violating any double spending, and it's adhering to the rules of the network. I'm going to broadcast that to the other node, the other members. So over here, member whatever, I'm going to broadcast it. When another member receives a transaction from another TE, because they've already established that trust with that TE, they trust any of its output. So if it sends it and says, here's a transaction that's valid, it's going to say, great, I'm going to go ahead and apply that to the blockchain that I've got, the copy of the blockchain I've got. Even if it's smart contract code, they don't even need to go rerun it. So it could be a very complex operation.
I see.
They don't need to rerun it. They just take the results.
So the part that I'm missing is because, remember, the Ethereum needed this ether to fuel this. Yeah. Are there still computation of hashes in here?
There's no computation of hashes. I mean, some network might charge something to keep members from DOSing the rest of the system. Mm-hmm. But there might be throttles or whatever. But there's no burning of energy. And there's no need to even redo the computations. Because even in Ethereum, for example, every node that's a miner in Ethereum replays the smart contracts to just to validate that they're actually, the results are actually what they were told by another member, another node.
So the reason why so we've established that because of these TEEs, you can create some private consortium. And they might have one machine, that everyone agrees that we're going to use these kinds of TEEs.
Yeah.
Now you've established privacy in a network.
Yep.
The second thing that I was worried about is this is going to take a long time, but you're no longer having to compute the hashes, and you're no longer having to rerun all the code, the code contracts in a block.
Right.
And so the speed's going to be much faster. I mean,
yep.
What are you seeing?
So you just submit the transactions, and now you establish what's called consensus, meaning all the nodes agree about the state of the world, using traditional distributed systems consensus technologies, which can deliver extremely high throughput.
Sure.
If you watch the video that we recorded and posted with the channel with the Azure blog post where we announced COCO, we show side by side off-the-shelf Ethereum running on a multi-node collection of virtual machines, and we show the same Ethereum integrated with COCO on an equivalent set of hardware.
I see.
And then we feed them, both of them, 2,000 transactions that we've recorded, pulled off the public blockchain, Ethereum blockchain, at the same time. And the latency that you see in the public one is, of course, what you'd expect out of the public Ethereum network, which is roughly 10 to 20 transactions per second. And the throughput, that's the throughput. The latency is up in the tens of minutes, because not only do you have to wait for all these blocks to get mined, you also have to wait a few blocks to be committed.
Oh,
remember, we talked
about
that.
That's right.
You want to make sure that you're not going to have to undo anything.
Right.
So you wait for a certain depth to show up to protect against forks in the network. And so that adds to latency. So the latencies that you see on that are tens of minutes.
And here it's not going to be because the network's going to be smaller, first of all. Yep. Consensus is going to reach faster, and the number of transactions that are happening is probably the same, but not as much as in the public blockchain.
Yeah, exactly right. And then the COCO-enabled Ethereum, we show about 1,500 to 1,600 transactions per second, which is up, you know, towards Visa-type throughput. And this is a prototype, so we can do better. We're working on consensus algorithms to improve the speed of consensus in good-sized networks. And so this is the kind of two orders of magnitude, basically.
I mean, it feels a lot faster. So we worked out the privacy thing. We worked out that it's faster because, one, we don't have to mine blocks anymore. We don't have to run the contracts anymore. And then consensus happens a lot faster in a smaller network. The one thing that I'm still not clear on is this notion of a constitution or governance, as you call it. So tell us about that.
So let's talk about constitution. I also want to talk a little bit about how this helps confidentiality.
It might be
kind of obvious, but actually just it's worth touching on.
Sure.
But for the constitution, let's just take, for example, the case where somebody in the network says, I want to add somebody to the network. So instead of this being completely out of band, they simply submit a transaction, an administrative transaction, that proposes the admission of a new member to the network. Now the other member nodes pick that up, and their members, their entities that are managing that, can look at it and say, do I want to add this? You know, am I okay with adding this other member to the network, this other bank, for example? If I am, or if I'm not, I submit a transaction representing my vote. And the Constitution can have codified rules in it that say, if the majority of the members say it's okay, then the network will allow this new member into it. So each member gets to vote by submitting administrative transactions. The COCO code takes a look and sees, you know, what the threshold is according to the Constitution. And these can be arbitrary rules. I mean, you could say only one member has to say, add this other guy, and it's going to get added. Or, you know, we need at least two to say it's okay. Or we need half plus one. Or we need two-thirds. Whatever the rules are, COCO will enforce them. And only the network, trusted network, will only let that member join if the Constitution matches with the votes.
And that's interesting because now questions of administrivia become transactions, and everything is the same as it was before.
Yeah.
And they have to follow the particular rules that are in the Constitution. Yeah. And the thing that I saw is that there can be different versions of the Constitution and the contracts and the data.
Everything about the operation of the network can be codified in Constitution and then updated according to the rules of the Constitution, including, hey, do we want to use the next version of this ledger, like version 3 of Ethereum, let's all vote on that.
Okay.
And then we'll, stop working with members that haven't upgraded to that. Or how do we upgrade COCO together and agree on that? That's all done through constitution and administrative transactions.
So the other thing that was kind of interesting to me was when we talked about, for example, in the sales, like suppliers and such, if there's a bunch of suppliers in this private network, they can still see transactions happening. How does this remain private even within the network? Because I thought like, oh, they're in their own network. They're going to be private. But there still might be competition even in that.
Yep.
How do you fix that?
So in this network, let's say that member one is one supplier. Over here, there's member two's node over here, another supplier. Here's member three. And what came in is a transaction from member one to member three. So member two shouldn't see this. Right? So each of them have their own copy of the blockchain, and that copy is encrypted, so chain, and it's encrypted basically by the TEE. It's actually stored on disk, but it's encrypted such that only the TEE...
It's just garbage.
Just garbage. Now, so if I'm a member and I'm on the same box, I can't, you know, see the transactions at all. The only way for me to see them is to actually ask the enclave, the code in the enclave, to show me what's in the blockchain. And for this transaction, if we want it to be confidential, we basically put an access control list on it that says only member one and member three should be able to look at it. Now, member two comes along, whether it asks this node or this node, and says, hey, COCO, show me all the transactions. The ACL checks happen here by the COCO code, and it would say, oh, you're member two. There's an ACL on here that says you shouldn't be able to see this. So I'm not going to show you that contents of that transaction.
So here's a question. Let's just say member one sold something to member three.
Yep.
And then member three sold that thing to member two. So there's like a chain. How does everybody know
there'd be another one here, member three to member two. Member two and member three would be able to see this. Member one and member three would be able to see this. They implicitly trust these transactions. Or remember we talked about they have to be chained because they trust Coco and the ledger to be following the proper rules and not be double spending and doing forks and things
like
that.
So even if they could never see the transaction, they can trust that member three indeed has those coins that were given to it by member one.
Yeah, coins or whatever assets they represent.
Yeah. And so that, I see. So, I mean, we talked about, the proof by induction, mathematical. Yeah. If the last one's good, everything else in the future should be good too.
Yep.
That's awesome. So is there anything else that I missed? I feel like we've covered the privacy and we've covered the governance and then we've covered the speed and latency issues. Is there anything else that I'm missing?
So just one more point on the confidentiality. The confidentiality rules can be arbitrary. And we, just to highlight just how easy it is to integrate a network with Coco, we had a developer, granted he's a good developer, take about 2 months to integrate Ethereum with the Coco framework and to add confidentiality capability to smart contracts. Given Ethereum running on Coco framework, off-the-shelf smart contracts will work. They'll be public.
Right.
But if you add a couple methods to your smart contract that Coco knows about, it will enforce confidentiality on the smart contracts, basically using access control as kind of protection. And that shows you just how easy it is. Most of the integration was actually taking stuff out of Ethereum because Coco does those things. Like the mining was taken out, the consensus algorithm was taken out, the peer-to-peer communication parts were taken out because now Coco is doing that using this trusted network.
I see. So one of the benefits of this is we're not wasting power doing this stuff because if everyone starts using blockchain for doing just regular business transactions, we're going to run out of power.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
So this, we really think, we've talked to, we've got huge, huge interest in this from many different sectors, health chain supply chain, healthcare, financial, for leveraging this. And we kind of really think about it as a foundation of blockchain for the enterprise or blockchain for business. This really enables kind of enterprise capabilities for blockchain networks.
So the last question is, because I saw this, someone mentioned this and I thought I would ask you, do all of these machines have to live in Azure, for example, or in the cloud, or can they be on-premise?
Yeah, awesome question. And actually, the Coco framework we're going to make it open source early in 2018, where it's freely available, free to use. We are encouraging and actually working with several of the ledger vendors or backers to integrate their ledgers with them. I mentioned Sawtooth Lake and Quorum. Mm-hmm. We're working with JPMC, which is Quorum and Intel, to integrate Sawtooth Lake. And then we'll be working with others as they come along. We expect the open community to also integrate. But as far as where you run the miners, again, you don't have to run them in Azure. You can run them anywhere. We expect it will really depend on the consortium and their own requirements and needs. You might have a consortium that says, oh, Coco's awesome. We're completely on-prem right now. And so our financial clearing is happening on-prem. So we're going to create a Coco network, a blockchain network in our own data center.
You just have to buy the right hardware that supports TE.
Or software, use virtual, Windows Server 2016. Some consortiums might have, a customer of Azure's, a customer of another cloud, another customer that's on-prem still. And so these member nodes can live in different places there as part of a network.
I see. So this is, and that was an interesting question because if it's a distributed ledger and it's all in one place, is it really a distributed ledger anymore? So you're saying it can be pretty much anywhere.
Yeah. Now the thing is, I do expect that we'll have customers that fully put the network on Azure, where all of the members of the consortium are on Azure, and take advantage of Azure's global scale. The one member might be in India, another member in U.S., another one in France, and so they can have their member nodes running close to them. Uh-huh. And still, they don't, trust each other. Other than to interact through this trusted network like this.
And I've recently learned that, like with Azure, we have a global network. That's like you get to your endpoint in let's just say you're in Ireland, right?
Yeah.
It goes to the data center there, and then everything else in Azure globally is on its own network.
Yeah,
Yeah, so I mean, you're going to get speed and
dark
security.
Dark fiber, yeah, or dark fiber network, yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Well, where can people go to find out more about this if they're excited to participate? I know you said that these things will be available early 2018, but what if people want to start testing these things or using these things?
Yep, so they can go to read the Azure, you know, go to the Azure blog where we've got the information about the launch of COCO. They can email me, actually, markruss@microsoft.com, mm-hmm. and I can, you know, handle it and connect them with the right people to mm-hmm. work with them on this. And then they can go to the Azure site where we've got information about our blockchain program. We have contact information there as well.
Well, this has been awesome. Thanks so much for spending some time, because this makes a whole lot more sense. I feel like I know about blockchain, and I'm excited about what we're doing with this, because like environmentally, I don't think this is sustainable if we do the old way
anymore. Absolutely. Yeah, certainly, you know, the other problem, not to mention the other problems that get in the way of business scenarios.
Right. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks
so much for watching. We've been learning all about blockchain, Ethereum, and now the COCO framework that's going to enable businesses to use these wonderful distributed ledgers in a way that actually is useful. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. Thanks so much for watching. We'll see you next time. Take care.